All right, given that it's the first thing Friday morning after a long conference, I reworked it last night. I did some dynamic treatment optimization as well. I put in some more red meat, and I took out some of the algorithmic details and stuff, thinking that's probably not what you want to hear this morning. So yeah, Opie's for the matches. I mean the title pretty literally. You know, I have software, so I see it on the front line because I get a lot of papers review. I get a lot of questions emailed, and you know, it's like people think it solves problems, it doesn't. They just like feeling better. So you know, it's like the vague hand gesture towards selection on observables. I mean, the problem is like we all agree that design trumps analysis, or most all of us, right? And that's like even the title of a recent paper by Don Rubin. But we can't mass produce design, right? You know, regression discontinuities that Aaron was talking about the other day, they're rare. Natural experiments that are compelling are rare. RCTs are relatively rare. So, well, we're in the current age, we're into mass producing quote-unquote science, so we got to move on. So in this literature, we assume selection observables. And needless to say, it's done too quickly. There's no design, right? You know, you just get some data, you're like, well, I assume it holds. Right, in some cases, you know, but what I mean by design is like, for example, I have a paper on using redistricting as an identification strategy. And every 10 years, we redistrict congressional districts in the United States. And then they move precincts around. I have the software the redistrictor uses. Political scientists consult with redistrictors. I have the databases they used in the law, in the legal proceedings. Since I'm doing the analysis after, I have more covariates than they did. Right, so you can start making a compelling argument about selection on observables. Right, you have the algorithm that was used, you have the covariates, you have actually a superset of the covariates that they used, right? There's something. It still might not be right, but there's at least some gesture or hope for, you know, there's some plausibility to it. Placebo tests aren't done, right? Can you, you know, can where the selection is similar, can you get a known result? You know, known positive or negative, right? Even when they exist, they're ignored, right, often. Like the hormone replacement therapy, it was 33% decline in mortality, right? And then there's a long list of others that when they're there, they're not done, et cetera, et cetera. My personal favorite here is the clearest one is that people have used matching in experiments they think is kind of gone goofy, right? And there's one-way non-compliance, right? Everyone assigned to control takes control. Not everyone assigned to treatment takes treatment. So in a famous case experiment that they thought the randomization wasn't quite right, turned out it to be just fine. They said, all right, I'm gonna go estimate the average treatment effect for the treated. I'm going to ignore the randomization, right? So I'm going to match compliers and treated to everyone who never took anything, right? The implicit logic of that is I can separate compliers from non-compliers, right? So you get an immediate placebo. You should be able to get the zero back by matching people assigned to treatment who didn't take the treatment with the people assigned to control and get the zero back. Right, because that's the logical consequence of being able to do the other. And if you do it, it actually fails. And quite stunning fact. You know, so people don't do it. They don't even think they'll. Balance checks are rudimentary. Like, one of the few benefits of matching, and I do think it does have some benefits, is that some of the diagnostics are pretty clear. Right, if you make this horrific assumption, right, which is almost never true, well, then there's some way to proceed, right, that you're going to say that I'm going to do my matching, I'm going to get covariate balance on my observables, then do you. Right, in a review article by Austin in Epi and Medicine, less than a third of articles using matching report any balanced statistics whatsoever. And when they do, it's almost always just covariate means for covariates which are not ellipsoidally distributed, which is, you know, not exactly a good thing. Inference questions are ignored. I mean, these are the kind of stuff that Alberto was talking about. This we can solve our way, or more accurately, this other people can solve our way out of. So the applied persons have to do it. Even if selection observables holds, the adjustment can be pretty inadequate, right? What's often not appreciated is even under that assumption, right, you still gotta do something, right? It could be that if my p-score is not correctly specified in a finite sample, I'm gonna have still really bad bias. And even under this assumption, right, if my p-score is misspecified, or if I'm matching directly in the covariates and whatever loss function of imbalance, whatever measure of imbalance I'm minimizing is weird relative to the response surface, I still might be better off not doing any adjustment, right? And that's usually pretty surprising to applied people, but generating examples like that is, like unsimulated data is pretty straightforward. And if you think about it for a second, it's ought not to be that shocking, right? So in a sense, it's related like to the economists in the room, to in welfare economics. If I have two inefficiencies and I get rid of one, you can't make the claim that that's Pareto improving, right? So you have to make an assumption about how those two inefficiencies are correlated. If I have one inefficiency and I get rid of it, all right, that's Pareto improving, right? So you get the same issue that if I reduce, like say, the covariate mean differences, but I make the variances bigger, right? That may or may not increase or decrease my bias on my estimand, even under selection observables, because it all depends on the response surface, right? What's more important? So adding to the problems, one of the other nice benefits I thought of this was tied to the Neyman-Rubin model, which made certain questions clear, but even that's going away. Now you're getting papers which are like, I'm doing whatever I was going to do before, except now I put matching in the beginning of it, at which point, I don't know. So now it's just like any other non-parametric estimator, and you're like, well, I don't know if it's better or worse. It's kind of weird. So a lot of these problems really aren't like statistical theoretical problems. They're just ones that are really about applications. Another way of thinking about it is we keep having the same debates over and over again, right? They never end, right? If you Campbell, internal validity, Kornbach, external validity, replace Campbell with Imbens, Kornbach with Deaton, and you have like a recent exchange in econ the last few, Heo's paper just only came out like two weeks ago. Right, it's the same debate. It's sort of like without random assignment, you don't get internal validity, and without random selection, you don't get external validity. But somehow we don't like that. We sort of want to say more than that. We keep circling around, right? In Bergson's paradox, you have M bias, right? Never dies. Actually, his original paper actually had a pretty compelling example, but people don't like it. It's no one disagrees that that one isn't an empirical. It's hospital admissions. Two different things, they're independent, but a condition on at least one of them occurring once, and that's gonna, of course, induce a dependency. And that's one that everyone empirically agrees. So we need some calibration, right? See, no one disagrees that internal external validity is important or unbiased can occur. Well, I shouldn't say no one disagrees, but almost no one disagrees that it can occur. The only question is how much does it occur, right? So that's a theoretical question. I can't sit in my armchair staring at the ceiling and answer it. I can't do Monte Carlo, I can't do a theorem on that. That's about the world, so you need calibration. But now there's actually a movement in a lot of literatures, including the one I'm going to talk about, undermining the intellectual support for that calibration. And some of the arguments are real. Whenever you try calibration experiment, external validity is a real problem. The example I'm going to talk about, the talk's from several different papers. The example's from a paper with Richard Grieve from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Right, in that literature, they go case mix. The case mix was different between the observational study and the RCT, right? And then there's also the private data issue that it's hard to do some calibrations, right? And Heckman and his students have particularly pushed this as a way of even saying that an RCT is not even a Brown standard. Our selection model fix-up should be the standard. You can't, right? So which is a nice gig, particularly when it's being pushed now to people, the members of the Council of Economic Advisors on healthcare reform, your measure cannot possibly be calibrated, period. Right? It's a nice gig. So the example I'm going to talk about, and I'll talk a little bit about the algorithms, but that's not really the main business of the talk, is cost-effectiveness analysis. This is coming to the U.S. In the Obama stimulus package, it's $1.1 billion for cost-effectiveness analysis. But they call it comparative effectiveness analysis. Cost would scare Americans. And this thing is asking for a pretty subtle estimate, right? Regulators that use this in healthcare ask for more subtle things than the FDA. FDA, for all its problems, makes pretty blunt decisions, right? So this is really gonna ask, is treatment A more cost-effective than treatment B? So I need costs, I need healthcare outcomes. The people who do this want long-term cost data. Right, in theory, they want the total lifetime effect. So so people who do this, they want long-term experiments, but they're rare, so they go to the observational data. Cost data from experiments are unrepresentative, right? So in the US, everyone, like people who do this in the US go, well, in the US, they're unrepresentative because, we have a private healthcare system, And then when you do an RCT, it's funded through a different mechanism. Well, they turn out that in Britain, the experiments NICE does are just as unrepresentative, right? And for CEA, they have a belief, rightly or wrongly, that people are more biologically similar across the population than their costs are. I don't know if that's right or wrong. I have no idea, but that's a belief, right? That to explain why the costs don't match up, right? And the key thing is, these guys want really subtle estimates, and they want it from observational data, right? And that's a little tricky, right? To give you an idea, as my co-author Richard keeps talking me into writing this stuff for NICE on, post-hip replacement blood clots are a big issue. Pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis, right? So the standard of care is low molecular weight heparin, right? And in Britain, NICE wants to say that's expensive, although it's not, it's like $100 a day, you need it for about 5 days. Based the surgery costs were 10 grand, so you're like, what? But aspirin's gonna cost pennies. So when he first approached me, I go, wow, that's gonna take a lot of power. It's a very subtle difference on the cost side. And they're like, the experiment's not cost effective, we wanna do observational data. Right, you sneeze on the estimate and it's going to bounce around, right? Because you're talking a very subtle effect. So to ask that from observational data is kind of heroic. Part of the issue is in rooms that this is being discussed in the U.S., it's mostly now social scientists. So we haven't done enough damage to our own fields, we now want to do damage to other fields. And statisticians, there's fewer and fewer of them over time. You can talk about the sociology of why that is. And so in other words, things that the victory of randomization is in this field is being layered back. Like Fred Mostel, before he passed away, was really worried about this. So where's the summary of the talk? There is meat, although most of it's red. There is actually substantive meat coming. The example is pulmonary arterial catheterization. It's a prominent example in the matching literature. And it's a weird example. I'll give you more details about it. Is that for people like me who don't think ask much about observational work, we think it's a great success of observational work. I made a list of success of observational work because most of what I teach is so negative, and I go, hey, I need a list of successes I actually believe. And not only do I believe that I can get past both Don Rubin and David Friedman, right? And this is on the list. And it's on the list for a reason to change the status quo belief of how effective it is. For regulators like NICE, it was bad. Because they didn't recover the RCT. The RCTs all say it has a zero treatment effect. All the observational work, even after the RCTs come out, say it has a big negative effect, right? Before any observational work done, doctors thought it was very positive. The first RCT, which was tried in Canada, failed because they couldn't get enough doctors into ecupause. They couldn't get them to think, be uncertain enough. Right? To me, it's a big success of observational work. Got doctors into ecupause, you could do the RCT, you found out it's a zero. All right, you learned something. That's a big success. But to a regulator like this, that's not enough. Right? Because if they're making these subtle life and death decisions, they actually want a pretty precise estimate. So you get this oddity that to someone with like my kind of belief, this is a big success, but if you want a subtle inference from it, it's not. So we'll talk about details. I got into this because even after they knew the RCT, they did a parallel observational study. They still couldn't get the zero back. They sent me the data without any whys. I didn't want any outcome data. Because one of the other few benefits of matching is I can separate the design stage from the outcome analysis stage, so don't give me any whys, right? So, I run this algorithm, which I'm going to briefly describe, and I get much better covariate balance than any of the 7 published articles on PAC, and I get their zero back. So they're very happy, and the first lesson is that the balance wasn't very good. But they're very happy, but they really shouldn't be, right? For reasons I'll describe, that if it wasn't an experimental benchmark, we'd still be bickering what to condition on. Right, because I got the X's and I looked at it and I conditioned on everything that I thought was important, including relying on secondary literature. But that included what kind of hospital you were and where it was. Like London has more research hospitals in Northern Ireland. Right, to a regulator, that's uncomfortable. Right, so they go, don't condition on that. I'm like, why not? I conditioned on it. Right, we'd still be arguing that fight if they hadn't taken the data and then try to get rid of it and try to get the RCT back, and they can't. And they go, oh, right. Oh yeah, and you still can't get the cost back, right? So it's not really, there's a disagreement between my co-author and I. I'm not really all that happy about it, right? I don't think it's a big success. He thinks it is, so we'll. So usually people wonder, so what is he talking about? I thought if I had selection observables, life's pretty easy, right? But it's not, right? Even if I have that, I need some other assumptions to say that my bias and my estimate is going to be better. If I have the correct propensity score, okay, that's fine. That'll do it. But if you have the correct propensity score, are you any more likely to have that than the correct model of the response surface? Right? So, all right. So if you go to the theorems, they're very limited. They're very, very limited. There's one set, which still may not be enough, but it is if you assume, like they did in the articles, that the response surface is linear, right? Is there's a property, equal percent bias reduction, which says that when an estimator, a matching estimator, has this property, when you match, the bias on the x's will all be reduced by the same proportion. So this is the bias in the x's, not on the estimand. And all affine invariant matching methods have this property if the x side is ellipsoidally distributed. It's been extended by an Annals article to a discriminant mixture of ellipsoidal distributions, but that's not really much of an extension, right? So in practice, it's not going to really hold that much. But that's basically all you got. And even when it holds, it might not be what you want, right? If x1 is much more important in the response surface than x2, why do you want this property, right? But at least it has this one thing that you don't get. To this day, I still get one email a month minimum, says, hey, I did the matching thing, I used your algorithm, but the mean difference, right, and they use Mahoba's p-square, but the mean difference in some variable actually got bigger post-matching. And I go, that's not a bug, that's just what it does, right? When this property holds, that won't occur. But when this property doesn't, you can match, and post-matching some function, some even linear function of the x's can be made worse than unadjusted, right? So all this property says is that when it holds, if I'm doing this as written down for ATT, that's my observed distribution of x and treated, observed distribution of x and control. That's the observed and treated, and that's my matched control. This is going to be, the gamma is going to be proportional for all. It's going to be equal percent, which is, again, a property you might not want. But at least we'll prevent these kinds of pathologies. In these papers, in the theorems, they assume a linear response surface. So this is a property you want then, right? But, you know, but a response surface is not, then...
A linear response surface after you transform the x's to be ellipsoidal?
Yes, yes. Yeah, exactly. At that point, it's sort of like, all right. So it's not in practice, it's not very useful. Like, people gesture towards this, and I'm like, this is not really... So we have a hard problem, right? We have a pretty hard algorithmic problem. And I don't want to walk through the algorithm because I talked about something else, but I want to tell you what the problem is. Now, whether you do it like I do it, which is tell the computer to do it, to be very explicit about every decisions, or you do it like Don has articles, which he goes, this is how you do with p-score matching, right? And he has an algorithm written. He doesn't call it an algorithm, but it's a procedure. You adjust the p-score, you add terms, et cetera, until it balances s and so. So whether you do it explicitly like I am or implicitly like most people, is what you got to do. First, this is even after selection observables. Right? That's a horrific assumption I've already granted. Even after that, I got to pick a loss function. Right? What am I minimizing? Right? Everyone doing a p-score has to pick the same thing. Right? Because no one that just estimates one model and stops, you just keep tuning the model, right? And every step when you fit that model, that's usually the logistic likelihood. That's actually not the thing of interest. Now, in a sense, that's a feature. That's a nice feature, right? Because what you can do is you're going to say, what I want is I want to say minimize the mean differences. Or something else, right? But there's an infinity of loss functions. You know, if you're into information theory, you might like Kubek-Leiber, you might like L1, you might like functions of the two-sample empirical QQ plots, you might like means, medians, but there's no principle to choose one over the other without some assumption on the response surface. But that would require knowledge of why, which has its own, so you're in this world of horrors on both sides, right? Alberto and I keep playing with writing a paper which you non-parametrically estimate the response surface, get the implied weights of the x's, you do the match and iterate until you stop. But now I need knowledge of why, right? So that gets rid of one benefit of this approach, but if you don't, you sin elsewhere. And the way you sin is I gotta make some stuff up about what my loss function is going to be important. Now, if I pick a loss function without any further assumptions, right, this is a really hard problem. This is an NP hard problem. It's a traveling salesman problem, right? So any algorithm that I'm gonna present, I can't claim anything about efficiency about it. Because if I were, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be, I'd be making billions because I'd be solving all NP hard problems efficiently, right? So what does that mean is that even if I had a deterministic Turing machine that was an oracle, it's gonna only get the solution polynomial time. It's actually gonna be less than that, but it's still gonna be polynomial time. But if you don't have an oracle, it's gonna be exponential, right? So you have a bunch of choices. If you're a machine learning person, for which I have sympathy with, you're in the world of heuristic search, which there are some theorems for, but it's generally, well, it sort of works, right? Or you got to make some simplification. You can say my propensity score is correct. All right, that gets you out of it. You can put a caliper on all the x's and say I'm done. All right, okay, fine, right? You can do what Alberto does in a synthetic matching, turn it into a convex problem, right? The problem is this problem is currently discrete. I'm matching one treatment to one or more control, and I'm matching it for placements. So you got to keep doing that. It's a discrete problem. What he does is match one treatment to a weighted average of all the controls. If you do that, you turn it into a convex problem, and then for certain cases, you have algorithms for even doing that in linear time. But that's a big assumption of smoothness, right? That I can take people, you know, if I have a treatment observation of 10, I can match two controls. One has a million, weight them appropriately, and I can get the first moment back. And you're like, all right, right? But it's a big assumption, right? Because you got to do something, right? Otherwise, you get this NP-hard problem. So what I do, which is quite common in the heuristic search literature, is use a heuristic search algorithm. You tell me the loss function. It has some defaults. But remember, it's a big. You tell me the loss function, it will maximize it, right? That's the only thing I can claim. It will maximize it. Will it maximize it efficiently? No, because you can't prove that, right? Now, there's proofs. GAs can be understood as Markov chains of a particular type with exponential selection for people with better fitness defined by your loss function, right? That as population size, the number of trials you're doing goes to infinity, the probability of poorly fitting things in the population goes to zero. But that doesn't tell you anything that you're not going to take a billion years to solve the problem, right? So I'm not going to talk about the details of the algorithm. It does this. You give it a loss function, it's going to optimize it. It's going to pick the weights it's going to give to the matching things to get you the bias reduction on the x side you want. If you want L1, it'll do L1. If you say minimize all the means, it'll minimize the means, right? And it can't answer what to minimize because that's dependent on the response surface.
You just said this is NP hard. Then you said your algorithm's going to succeed.
Oh no. We have, but you might be. But I said it might be a billion years, right? So you don't. In heuristic search, all you can say is it's going to sort of make improving moves. Right? All you can say, it's going to make improving moves. That you're guaranteed.
What you're stopping.
Well, in heuristic search, it's all arbitrary. Right? It's all arbitrary.
So you mean your algorithm will converge before a million years, but it may be not the optimal?
If you ever have a converging rule to the algorithm, right, you cannot claim anything about that it's anywhere near the optimal. All you can say is it's made improving moves. Right? Because at any step, that's what it will do. But if you stop it at any point in finite time, you can't at all claim anything about efficiency. Right? This is true of all NP-hard problems, of which there are many. Right? And the heuristic search, you know, works well. I mean, Boeing designs airplanes using it, Intel designs chips using it, and Google's algorithms use it. Right? So, but all you can say is it's sort of good enough. Right? So whether it works or not, in the whole, you know, literature and engineering stuff that uses it is you calibrate it on examples. Right? Because you can't, because the theorems don't help you. Right? Because all you can do is, you know, you can make improving moves and they're all trivial. They're all delta. Right?
And it's sensitive to some starting value.
Yes. Because they're all heuristic search algorithms like this one, they're not all. All in this class are stochastic. So it's sensitive to starting values and the stochastic part. Now in the limit, which will be all dead, that washes out. But that's literally, because this is not asymptotic in sample size. This is asymptotic in what's called population time. You can think of it as runtime of the algorithm, right? That's the asymptotics are not in what you're used to. So by the end of the universe, you can, right? So that's all you can claim to it, right? So all you can do is you can say, all right, like in this literature, you have 7 articles published on plaque. You can show that this thing in an hour got much better balance than those 7 articles ever did, right? So, but there's no claim of optimality. There could be another algorithm that works better. Right, I'm working with some AI people on coming up with another algorithm, and they all come up, well, this is a better one, but they're all special cases. Right? You got to make an assumption, right? And then you have to debate, well, how representative is that special case? So that's the, right? So there's no optimality you can claim at all. And any stopping rule is going to be arbitrary. So this is a hard world. And that's the thing, you're always in this world, right? See, people usually don't observe it because they make some simplifying assumption. Which is fine, but that's an assumption, and then it becomes a practical matter. Does your approach work better or this? Right? And that's right? So pulmonary arterial catheterization, it's just a diagnostic. It's not a treatment. You get a catheter put on your pulmonary vein. It's usually done in ICUs for people with reduced blood flow in the heart. Heart attack cases are a big one to use. It's widely used for 30 years. We never did an RCT. We spend like $2 billion a year on it. That's the direct cost. The indirect cost is like $30 billion. So the RCTs all find no effect. Seven non-random studies find that it kills people. And as I said, this I find, and even David Friedman, head observation, found a great success of observational work. It changed the status quo belief of practitioners. They all thought it worked. And now most are in equipoise, right? Not all, but most. And the other thing is, in the literature, if you read the substantive people, there's no article saying among doctors or MDs that actually we think it's negative. They all write, actually, I think it's positive for some subgroup, but they can't find it. One of the nice things about this example is you get the RCT, you can change the null, you can do subgroup analysis. Published papers do subgroup analysis, don't do any multiple testing correction. They still can't find a subgroup, right? So they're biased towards finding one, and they still can't find one. So there's a case where it might really actually be zero. So there might be some calibration. Depends which trial. 2003 to 2004, right? So in the UK, what they did is, because they're very worried, they did a trial and a parallel observational study. Same entry and exclusion restrictions, UK ICUs. There's overlap of units in both. So you have overlap of units in equipoise, right? So because this was designed because they didn't like this result. But it wasn't, because, you know, they're in the world of making life and death decisions on observational data. So they collected data, and they have really good covariates. The most important is the probability of death, which is this long list of clinical covariates that my co-author can describe vastly better than I can.
I'm lost. Are you telling me the trial was done in 2003?
Yeah, yes, both. Both were done. Both were done. There was a parallel design. They were both doing it. They had some overlapping units, some non-overlapping units, same entry and exclusion restrictions. Compliance is not, another nice thing about this is the compliance is not a big issue here, right? You're in the ICU, this is Britain, compliance rate. So compliance is not an issue. So that usually kills observational studies, right? Compliance is, it's hard, right? It's hard to get an observable on it too. So they collected all these covariates. Actually collected a lot of covariates in the RCT, so you can actually stack them up if you want it. Most important covariates, probability of death, which is this prognostic model they have from baseline covariates. That's length of stay, teaching hospital site. They're long. So they did the usual thing of P-score. They matched on it, and it got, again, it kills people, and I did my thing. Now, there's two things that happened. This was the first thing that explains. It's probably the death's most important covariate. The London P-score, the British P-score, has the best balance of all, as far as we can tell, of the seven articles on PAC. And this is the probability of death, and the means are well matched, but the higher moments are not. And this variable strongly... Okay, please.
Can you say the best? Is that seven articles on the same data
set? No, different data sets. This is a British one. Out of seven articles, there's five data sets. Five. Because the first one is the Connors data set. That's the US data set. That you can get. They didn't even report covariate balance, actually, in that article. And that was a very important one. That one actually is worse than this. They actually can't recover it. So it's five different data sets. So the British data set, now we can go into the details later, because there's nice things with the entry and exclusion that's, I think, making it easier for them to get covariate balance. So the means are well matched here, but the higher moments are not. So I used to cook up these examples, and people like Ben Hansen would say, it doesn't happen, I just have to worry about the means. Because you can cook up anything. And he's a good point, you can cook up anything. But this is actual data where the means are well matched and the higher moments are not. And if you look at the response surface after, these are very sensitive, right? So this is what it looks like after this goofy algorithm, right? So whatever the response surface is, if I have to choose between this and that, I don't have much choice, right? That's going to be better than that, right? Because there's no region of the empirical QQ that this has better covariate balance than that, right? That's not enough. If that was it, I might even have been happy, right? So here it is in tables. I always put p-values up because people always ask, but these aren't real p-values, right? So algorithms beat on the xi so hard. There's so much of a pretest problem. It's amazing. And oh, by the way, it's an observational study. I don't quite know where the p-values come from anyways. But they're always up because people ask. But the descriptive stuff is still the descriptive stuff, right? So this was the probability of death. That improved. Note the means were pretty good for the PAC, for the observational p-score. The interesting thing is the London percent in London hospital. Okay, ignore this. So this was this variable, which is the probability of death, unmatched, in no pack, it's 30% probability of death. It's very high mortality in this. In the pack group, it was 56%. After p-score matching, it was 58, 56, so it's very close. And after gen match, it's very close, too. So the so if you look at the means, you think you're doing well. The question was, the problem was the QQ plot. The other issue was the percent admitted to London hospitals, where the teaching hospitals are, disproportionately. And this is the metro area, so Radcliffe is in this group, for example. Unmatched is better than p-score matching. The propensity score actually made the covariate balance here worse. And this actually also strongly predicts the outcome, regardless of what NICE wants to believe. Right? So this is an example in the data where you actually made it worse doing the covariate adjustment than not doing the covariate adjustment. Right? So it was both of those things, but in this covariate, we could never agree on what to do. And all the ones are strictly better. So if you look at the odds ratios, how this literature likes it between the RCT and the thing, it matches. But don't be too happy. The costs still don't match. Yeah. Yes.
Each case.
No, it's estimated treatment effect for the treated. So you pick, for example, once one match, you pick one person from control to match the treated.
1:1.
Yeah, with replacement. That's the lowest bias estimator. That's kind of the lowest discrepancy.
With replacement.
Yes. Yeah. If you do it without replacement, the bias is worse on the X side. The method I'm using is guaranteed of matching estimators, modulo this distance, whatever distance you pick, to be the lowest discrepancy estimator, because you can't do better than 1:1 matching with replacement on the discrepancy side. You know, for efficiency, it might be a different issue, right? But on discrepancy, you're not going to do better than that. But the costs still don't match, and the signs are still wrong, right? In the RCT, you get a zero, and like every other cost side on this, this all shows that PAC is far more expensive. That's in pounds and bound away, right? So that's bad. This is on the cost side, so this is the cost of PAC versus non-PAC in pounds. The RCT finds a zero. And in this thing, like all the other observational things, finds the PAC is far more expensive than no PAC. So the cost side, it still doesn't match. Now you can think about it, and one of the issues is their covariates, because they spent a lot of time thinking what's the important covariates for the outcome being death. They didn't spend an equally hard amount of time thinking on what the covariate should be on cost. Like, they have probability of death. They don't have a metric for expected cost for the patient, for example. So if you think about it, for regulators so concerned about getting cost, they spend very little time collecting covariates that are predictive of that Y. So that might be one reason. Another reason might just be that the regimes are just different, right? So you can't tell. But this consistent, like, basically everything else you find, that even if you match it on the clinical side, on the cost side, getting it is very uncommon. Right.
What other things?
Oh, PAC is a diagnostic. Okay, what I've done it here is just cost. My co-author would put up Qualys. Quality adjusted life years, which does that. But now I have a huge house of cards. That has built into it, what would you rather do, lose a kidney or lose an eye? Right? Would you rather go blind or have a Qualys? That's all buried in there, and I'm like, my God, this is such a, right? This doesn't have that. So this doesn't value, this is just the procedures of the hospital and everything. I don't know if you should. No, I don't know.
Easily make.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Where?
No.
Randomized trials very well designed.
That's right.
And they know how they're going to spend.
That's right.
Well, an observational study, you get new data because you have that in. Oh my God, we have problems.
Right.
And you suddenly pick out things.
No,
wondering in the protocol of randomized what to do to this person. And
I absolutely agree, but the upshot of that is I can't calibrate my methods now.
I agree.
Right. I completely agree. I don't know what it is. But the key important thing to know is go, I don't know. They always leap to, it must just be that they're different. I'm like, maybe. Totally. I can't rule that out. I have great sympathy. But it could just be that you didn't collect the covariates for it. I don't know. Maybe the methods are bogus. Right? And then the other side is bogus also. So I don't know. So the thing is, I can't get calibration. But if I can't get calibration, how do I do this? We know these things are relying on these untestable assumptions, right? I agree. If I knew that that was the target, then at least I got calibration. I can move forward. But I don't even get calibration, because I just don't know. That's a worse world to be in, right? Can I take it after, unless it's, right? So people like Monte Carlos. I don't like Monte Carlos. I'm like von Neumann famously said, with four parameters, you can model an elephant. With five, you can make its trunk wiggle. So with a Monte Carlo, you're controlling so much. You get whatever answer you want. I don't know what to make of them, but people seem to like them, so I'll give you whatever answer I want. And the answer I give is, there's a true selection observables holds. There's a true propensity score. You misspecify the propensity score, but it's still like sort of rich. And then you do this algorithm and the machine learning thing, and it gets much lower bias and mean squared error. As I said, it's a Monte Carlo. So if I play around with the response surface, I can get the answer of, if I feed GenMatch the wrong loss function, and I pay around relative to the response surface, I can get a Monte Carlo that says, I shouldn't have even started that thing. I should have remained with the unadjusted. So as I said, it's Monte Carlo. I can get whatever answer I want. So, but people seem to like them, so here it is. So what's going on is the one thing I can claim is this thing will make improving moves on the bias, not on the estimate, but on the X side. So this is over across the Monte Carlos, the biggest gap, the D statistic is the biggest gap in the empirical QQ plot, right, for this covariate age, which is an important confounder. Across the 1,000 Monte Carlos, the black line is the density for the GenMatch thing, the red line is the p-score, and this gets, by you know, that measure of imbalance, this gets better than that, right? So, right.
Who says what model I have to use with the p-score?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I know you're going to play A.
That's right.
Why don't I put in
That's right. Absolutely.
25
That's right.
Basis?
That's right. That's right. No, absolutely agree, which is to say that I don't... There's no claim that someone using a p-score couldn't get this or even better than this, right? There's no claim about that. All I'm saying is that over 7 articles and 5 data sets, people didn't do it, right? That's the only claim. It could be that the best algorithm out there for this data set is a non-parametric estimate of the p-score. No denying that, right? Because once you're in these complicated search problems, there's no optimal solution. There's no optimal method. You can't say that. You don't have that, so you got to calibrate. That's the only thing you got. But that's true of all methods, right? Not just the one I'm talking about. You can't make an analytical argument for, hey, my stick's better than the next guy's stick. So this is coming in some way, and the biases can be found even when selection observables holds. You can show that analytically. You can show that by Monte Carlo. That I can nail. So the reported variance estimates from this kind of stuff really underestimate our true uncertainty. And I'm even dodging the issue that I'm getting variance estimates in an observational study, and which there's no, where I'm making up a randomization model and a probability model, but all right, we like doing that, so fine. So to this cost-effectiveness analysis and the fights in the administration, and where I talk to people in Health and Human Services, and this is actually being led by OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, ORZAG, the economist. You might see them in the New York Times sometimes, big fan of this. Most people object to it on moral grounds. I'm a scientific one, right? If you're going to ration care, just stand up and say it. Don't hide behind this fake scientific defense for it, right? So machine learning can help with some of the problems, right? And there's no optimality. Lots of different algorithms could be used. I don't know. But human beings, the one thing we do seem to know in this and many other examples, human beings sort of suck at tweaking the p-score themselves. Right, there's been lots of examples in literature, and you actually look at the reported balance the p-score get when they themselves tweak it. They generally don't do well. In this case, it vaguely worked, but we'd still be fighting if we didn't have an RCT to calibrate at least one covariate on. The cost side is still uncalibrated, right? So I don't know what to make of it. So some of the problems we can solve, but the deep ones in this that are not statistical algorithmic problems. Right, and playing around with that isn't gonna solve what the cost should be, what's the target, what's the calibrate, right? That's Jamie's question. I don't know what the right answer on that is. I can't get an algorithm to tell me that because how do I validate the algorithm, right? So I'm out of time, so I guess I should be quiet. I think I ran over because our. Stepped out. Question, Thomas.
So this is a very question, but I thought that there were some arguments that showed you could define classes of stochastic algorithms, and there are Markov Chain Monte Carlo algorithms, there are subclasses of the matching algorithms, and sort of very impressionistic result that I was told that basically the genetic algorithms that are not Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithms have problems that that basically the qualitative summary I was told is if your genetic algorithm is a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm, then it has nice properties and it's converging to a stationary distribution. If it's a truly genetic algorithm that is not a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm, then it has problems. Basically, it's not clear that there's a limit distribution that's a big mess.
Yeah. That's my understanding of the analytical literature as well. This is a GA. It does have the Markov property. Like Koza, for example, at Stanford does genetic programming, and his don't. In practice, they might actually work quite well, but they don't get any of the but you can't get any of the machinery people have worked out to try to figure out what the limiting behavior of these things is, so it's a mess. But this one does have the GA property. It's a GA, not a GP. So that's my understanding as well. But again, I will say, just because Koza's algorithms don't have that proper, that analytical, it can't hook into those theorems. I don't know whether in practice it works better or worse, right? Because the theorems don't, they give you something. Like intellectually, we have this behavior. We're like, oh, yes, we like some theorems, even if the theorems themselves have infinite in runtime. And we like that, all right. But in a finite sample, I'm not sure the way to choose algorithms is that we can write some theorem that gives some limiting behavior that we all acknowledge that in practice is completely unclear, right? But no, I've chosen that route, right, because this has the Markov property. But what I'm telling you is that's not the reason to like it or not like it. That's not really giving you any information. It's giving you, but that's my understanding too, so I hook into it and I do it, but, you know, I'm not sure it gives me much. But this is a Markov chain, so you can do the limiting property of exponential selection on fitness, is what you get. So,
I mean, as a minor aside, there are genetics people in my department who looked at genetic algorithms, and they basically said the conclusion they came to was what you would have known if you were Darwin, which is that finding optimal solutions takes a very
long time. Yes, that's right. That's absolutely true. So the one thing about GA is they parallelize easily. And so at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, I got a very big cluster. My software is written in C, and it parallelizes linearly. It does parallel. The only thing linear I got, and I worked hard, is it linearly parallelizes across chips, which is not so easy. And it's also vectorized on your chip. Your chip, like Intel chips, have a vector processing part. The code's written to hit the vector part. So, but it takes a very long time. It's like for other people to use it, using this thing, but when I said it takes an hour for me, that's like if I took it on my laptop, I don't know how long it'd take. If it take on a workstation, I think that would be equivalent to like 4 days. But it took me an hour, so. All right, okay, so what you gotta do is that there's many things you can parallelize, so there's two layers of parallelization. The first is you're picking trial solutions, right? So what you got to do is you got to say, I got a loss function that's already picked, and I'm picking trial weights to give all these x covariates to match that loss function. So that's what the population is. So if my population is 5,000, for every until I'm done with those 5,000, until I take the next step, that's a parallel thing. Those 5,000 evaluations can happen independently. Once they're done, it makes the decision of who to breed, who to kill, who to mutate, and that can't be parallel, but that's a quick thing. The hard part's the function evaluation. Because think about the functional evaluation and matching. It's about n squared log n. It's less than that, because you don't have to do a quick sort, which is n log n. So it's a little faster, but it's still, because what you gotta do is you picked a distance metric, say it's the p-score, doesn't matter, right? I take my treated, I gotta sort, I gotta do a partial sort on the controls. You gotta do what's called a kth sort. If I do one-to-one matching, I gotta find the kth element, which is one, that I'm close to. Then I got to go to the next treatment, do another kth sort on the controls. You get the idea, right? So that's a polynomial time procedure, and I got to do that for every trial solution. That's why you can write that the oracle would do this in polynomial time, because the oracle knows the true weights. But it's still going to take polynomial time, because just like if you know the true pre-score, it's a polynomial time problem for you, right? Because you still got to do those partial sorts at each t and right, so that's what I'm parallelizing, because that's the easiest, because there's little communication costs across it.
Can I ask a more fundamental philosophical
right.
question?
Can you look at the time?
Yeah, I think we should. Yeah.
I didn't mean, I have 20 minutes.
Yeah,
that's probably.
Oh, I should. Sorry. Sorry, I should apologize to.